Ring the Bell Santo? This is Movie Fighters, the show where Chris Sims and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and we beat them up. And this week, we have a very special guest. Yes, someone has joined us to fight a movie for the first time ever.
In Movie Fighters history.
That's right. This week, we are it's all because of bribery that welcoming Jay Gonzo to the show.
Am I really your first guest?
Yes.
Wait, no, you guys did the Die Hard with a guest.
Well, that was technically an episode of War Rock and Ajax.
Oh, okay. I thought that was Movie Fighters because, you know, you watched a movie.
And it went up on both feeds.
And we we did a commentary track instead of what we always do here, which is the
reactionary
podcast.
Track is That's right. what I think we're doing.
The reactionary track. That's right. And the movie we are watching on this episode is, I guess it kind of fits in with the Pulp series that we just did.
I was thinking about that today, that we did not pick it so that it could make an easy transition out of the Pulp series, but it does kind of fit.
The movie we are watching is El Santo versus the Vampire Women. And weirdly enough, the version that we're watching, which is dubbed into English, changes El Santo's name into Samson for reasons that I do not fully understand.
I went looking into that. I tried to see why they went Santo or Samson instead of Santo, and my guess is that it just sounded too ethnic, because I could find no reason online, really. I dug into all the trivia facts. This guy I know who writes books on Latino cinema, especially like this exploitation kind of stuff, he had no answer for me. It was just a completely flippant decision that I think just anglified it.
Well, that is the better of the two new names for El Santo that we get in the English dubs. The other one being Silver Mask Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just, I mean, come on. Like, that Samson, they're at least trying.
I guess it was really expensive to dub films back in the 60s. And so really of this kind of golden age of Lucha Libre movies, this is one of like three that really made it over into America. The rest of them, they just subtitled or ran in Spanish. So, I thought that was weird. And I've seen all of these, but I guess I've only seen them in Spanish and just didn't understand most of them.
Well, that was one of the things that I wanted to talk about, was that this movie. Now, we are, of course, America's only bad movie podcast.
Oh, yeah.
That is, we were the first ones. We are still the only ones. No one else is out there. You know, there's no other show where two or three people sit around and watch a bad movie and then crack jokes about it for about an hour. That does not happen anywhere else. But if there is a grandfather to the bad movie podcast, it is, of course, Mystery Science Theater 3000. And I think this one, do I have it right? Was Samson versus the Vampire Woman, was that done on Mystery Science Theater?
Yes.
Because I know they did a couple of Santo movies.
It is.
Oh, yeah, it was.
This is one of the movies that they did. Just to add in a fact here, there are 52 El Santo movies. This one is from 1962. It is widely regarded as the best one, though it is not the most successful. The most successful El Santo movie co-starred Blue Demon and Mil Máscaras and came out in 1970. That was called The Mummies of Guanajuato. But this one is kind of regarded as the best. It's got higher production values than other El Santo movies. It's sort of El Santo in his prime. And
it's like his fourth or fifth movie. The first three he does kind of bit parts. He's kind of like, you know, Dwayne the Rock Johnson, where he just kind of has these little cameo roles, and it takes him three or four movies to really star in one. And
right,
the movie before this, which was I believe is Versus the Zombies, was his first kind of he's being him. It's El Santo as El Santo, and it was really well received, and so they gave him this next starring role in which he fights the vampire women. But he's also, and in his prime, he's also 45, I think, in this movie.
Yeah, but like he was continuing to make movies until at least the late 70s, right?
I mean, he makes movies, I think, yeah, like until 77, I think, is his last movie, if I'm not mistaken. But he also wrestles until 1982. So he wrestles from when he's 17, which is like 1927 or something, until 1982. I mean, the man wrestled for almost 50 years. I think just shy of his 65th birthday, he retires, and then a year later, he goes on Mexican television and out of nowhere pulls his mask off, and then a week after that, he passes away at the age of 66, and they buried him in his mask, which is amazing.
It's like a storybook.
Yeah.
But Chris, were you going to make another point about this movie being on Mystery Science Theater?
Well, no, I was just going to say that, like, I have actually, like, look, I'm a huge fan of Mystery Science Theater. Matt, I feel like you are. I feel like we've talked about it before, certainly.
Yes, yes.
Gonzo, I don't know where you fall on it, but that actually is one of the episodes I have not seen. So, we will not be intentionally lifting any commentary from that. one thing I do want to say, though, is that this was actually not our first choice for an El Santo. We knew we were going to do an El Santo movie. We knew that Gonzo was going to come and join us. Because this is something that we talked about as payment for the logo design and for driving us around in California while we were in San Diego last year. What we actually wanted to watch as our first choice was the movie where El Santo and Blue Demon fight Dracula.
And a werewolf.
And a werewolf, yeah. Yes. I guess there's a team up. But unfortunately, we could not track that one down. This one, we had a much easier time. And I say we. Gonzo had a much easier time finding.
Well, I could find. I found the verse. You know, the Blue Demon and El Santo versus Dracula and a werewolf. A really good HD, but it was in Spanish and there was no subtitle. I couldn't find a subtitled version of it, even let alone a dubbed. And I don't know how well subtitled is going to go over with us all watching a movie together.
Well, you know that in addition to being the king of sports, pro wrestling is the universal language.
Yeah, it really is. Which is why I used to watch these in Spanish and never, you know, and it wasn't until recently that I realized, like, oh, I was watching those in Spanish and had no idea what else was happening in them.
As I said, only 4 El Santo movies were ever dubbed into English. 48. We're all just left in Spanish. And I don't know about the subtitle situation. Do any of us know what the history is behind these luchador movies? Because it wasn't just El Santo. As we mentioned, you know, Blue Demon, Mil Máscaras, sort of the trinity of famous luchadors of their time, all starred in these movies, and they're all about them fighting monsters. Like classic movie monsters a lot of the time.
What I don't know how it came to the movies, but I do know that, and this is something that goes on today, there were comics, and they were these weird Fumetti comics. I did an article about them a long time ago.
Fumetti's a bit of a misnomer. Well, you continue, and then I'll jump in when you're done.
Well, they would cut out these action poses of El Santo, for instance, and then paste it into art of the Virgin Mary visiting him and sending him on missions. That is not me exaggerating. That is the plot of one of these comics. So I assumed that the comics came first and then were so popular because they were wildly popular.
Oh, yeah. The comic ran from – hold on a sec. I actually wrote that down. The comic ran from 1952 until 1987.
Yeah, huge. And, you know, even, you know, if you were watching SmackDown over the past few years, they would constantly tell you how Sin Cara still had a comic with over 50 issues because he was so popular in Mexican wrestling. I don't know if that is still a thing that goes on with Lucha Libre, but I know that that was a thing – where I think that predates the movies, and then they were so hugely popular because even, like, you know, the issues, I think they said that the average issue, much like American comics in the Golden Age in the 40s and 50s, would be passed around by like 5 or 6 kids, and they were still selling like millions of copies.
Yeah, you could sell them back. You could buy it one day.
That's what it was. Yeah,
you bought it for full price, and then you could sell it back for less money and get a credit, and then they would resell it. And so the initial sales numbers were just print numbers. And not to say, you know, these things would then get circulated, then resold and resold as a used comic, sold back, used comic. There was a guy named Jose Cruz who had started the El Santo comic, and he what he did is he would get El Santo for like a week or a couple of days to come in and just take all of these posed photos and reference number all of the prints of those. And then people would take those and literally draw over the prints of them. And so it was this weird mix of photography but with art literally drawn into the photo, like pencil drawing and what have you. And a lot of those old comics, you can see the pose number in the corner still. Like all the panels have like the reference number because they knew that, like, oh, here's El Santo lying down and here's him throwing a punch and here's him doing a Hurricane Rana or what have you. The first real kind of property when it came to and this is all from memory, so I could totally be wrong, but as far as Lucha Libre, like as far as personality went, was this guy named El Solitario. He looked like the Lone Ranger. And he was the first guy to really start doing merchandising stuff like dolls and or action figures and comics. And it was Jose Cruz, I think, saw that and then glommed onto El Santo kind of at the height of his popularity and helped elevate him to – well, actually helped elevate him to the height of his popularity. And that started out selling this comic called Caliman, which was like the number one selling comic in Mexico at the time. And I think at that point they were like, well, there's money to be made here. But they offered El Santo a couple of roles early on that he just couldn't do. And I'm trying to think the wrestler that actually ended up doing them. So there's a handful of movies that exist before these El Santo movies, but most of those were done because El Santo just couldn't do them until he did his first couple of cameos, and then those did well, and then he did the zombies, and that did great. And then I think this movie in particular kind of starts a bunch of imitators who then start trying to grab what other wrestlers do we have and popping them into movies.
According to Wikipedia, that wrestler that took Santo's place was El Médico Asesino.
Oh, yeah, gotcha. He's kind of that Dr. Wagner predecessor from the, like, 50s. Yeah.
He would wear a white mask compared to Santo's silver mask, which is why Santo was called the Silver Mask Man in some of those earlier movies. Okay.
I do just want to point out that there is one issue of the El Santo comic from the 70s that is described as a Star Wars ripoff. And if anyone knows where I can find that, if anyone has a copy of that, I would love to read it.
I know a guy. I'll see what I can do for you, Craig.
Thank you. You're a good man.
All right. Before we get going on Santo versus Las Mujeres Vampiro, we are going to do our blockbuster new segment on Movie
Finder.
Hottest
new segment, second hottest new segment in podcasting after MMA update on War Rock and Ajax.
Snack situation. We're going to find out what everybody's going to be snacking on as we're watching the movie. Gonzo, we'll start with you. What are you snacking on?
Well, as you know, I don't eat anything these days. So I went with I got a big bowl of Orville Redenbacher's Naturals, just simply salted popcorn, and a tall decaf Americano.
Very nice.
Interesting.
Chris, what's your snack situation?
I want you to imagine what Gonzo is eating, but then make it like a fat guy who doesn't care. Because I am literally eating a bag of Cape Cod white cheddar popcorn, and I have a cup of coffee that I'm about to finish with two sugars and cream. And also, my girlfriend, I believe, is in the process of making cookies, so I'm going to have a good day regardless.
I cannot believe this is the first time this has ever happened on Movie Fighters, and there are three of us, which makes it even crazier. We are all eating popcorn for this movie.
Amazing.
I have a bag of Smart Food white cheddar cheese popcorn that I'm going to be snacking on, and I'm drinking my customary bottle of Sun Drop. So that's what we're going to have for El Santo versus the Vampire Women. We're going to pause this right now. We're going to watch the movie. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about it. You can watch along with us if you would like on YouTube. It is actually up in full on YouTube. So if you want to go check that out, go check that out right now. We will be back in just a moment. All right, we are back from watching El Santo versus the Vampire Women. And despite moving rather slowly for the first little bit, and Santo not showing up for the first 26 minutes or so?
25 minutes and 46 seconds. I made sure to write that down.
It is a phenomenal experience. It is uplifting.
It's inspirational.
We learn a lot about what makes somebody just, and we'll get to what exactly Santo does to deal with the Vampire Women as we wrap up. But yeah, this was quite a film.
Oh yeah,
this is not a great movie. No. This movie is like Well, you said it's slow for the first little bit, Matt. And by the first little bit, you mean like the first 80 of the 90 minutes we just watched?
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty fair. Even though there are moments that are really, really good in that time frame, but they're kind of few and far between until you get to the end.
There's that. There's the fact that nothing in this movie makes sense or follows any kind of logic. I said about an hour into it that there is nothing in this movie that I would consider to be part of any kind of vampire movie. Like, until the last 5 minutes.
It certainly doesn't follow any kind of traditional vampire mythology.
Right.
Oh yeah, they seem to have their own personal take on vampirism, unique to the wrestling world, I would suppose.
I mean, I don't even think it's that. Like, it's... First of all, are we to believe that this movie takes place over the course of one night? Because they talk about things happening on multiple days, but we never see the sun. Always nighttime in this movie.
They're all kind of vampires. They're all up all night and then sleeping all day, apparently.
Yeah, I think that it does take place over 2 days.
Okay, because there's the first day, and there's the first night when the vampires wake up, which takes 8 minutes.
Yes, I guess we'll just get into describing what takes place.
I think
place
it's 3 days, though, to be clear, because there's the day where before her birthday party, there's the day of the party, and then there's
Santo's big match.
Yeah, and then there's the next day, so I think it's 3 days.
Everything happens the night of that big match.
So, on day one, we open on this mansion.
A castle. It is a castle.
It is a castle, you're right. It's an old castle. There is a painting of a woman named Rebecca in the main hall of the castle. And it's dated 1721. Or 61. Is it 1761?
It is 1761. Yes. Her name is Rebecca, spelled with one C.
Yes. We come down to the basement of this castle.
I believe that would be the dungeon, Matt. Castles don't really have basements.
It's technically a basement. The lower level. Let's say that.
Okay. There we go.
We can compromise with cellar if you want.
Okay.
We're in the lower level of the castle, and a vampire woman who has got like sort of some classic movie monster makeup on, where it looks really kind of craggy and but also very much like makeup. She comes out of a coffin super slowly. And then she starts giving this long speech where she explains that Rebecca is the former queen of the vampire women. By the way, this particular vampire, she's the one that does all the work throughout the movie. Her name is Tundra. She gives this speech about how Rebecca is the original queen of the vampires, and her descendant, Diana, is about to turn 21, and therefore it will be her time to become the queen of the vampires, while her predecessor is going to abdicate the throne. And what was the current queen of the vampires' name?
Selene.
Selena.
No, I thought Selene was when she was literally praying to the goddess of the moon.
No. Selene was the kind of interim.
You're right. Selene is the Diana Rigg looking lady with the tiara who shows up.
One of the transitions got fucked up. Like Selene was supposed to have Rebecca, I believe. I thought was supposed to take Selene's place,
right?
And that got screwed up. So Selene had to reign longer, which I think is why they're so decrepit and need the blood to kind of sustain them to their youth. Something got screwed up. Tundra fucked up once already. Do you guys swear on your show? I forget.
We do.
Okay, cool.
Tundra fucked up once already. It's a pretty good summary of this movie. Right, because
One of the hands-offs got screwed up, and that's why it's so important now, because Selene has been a queen too long, that this new successor come to power, that they secure Diana to take her place so that Selene can return to hell and be with her husband, Satan?
Yes. Rebecca went to go live a life of virtue, which also involved making some babies.
Yes.
Because she has a descendant who is that Diana?
Yes, it's Diana.
Yes, okay.
So all this information...
I don't know anyone's name in this movie except for El Santo and Professor Rollup.
It does sound like his name is Professor Rollup in the dubbing. I think it's supposed to be Rolov, But it sounds very much like Roll-Up.
No, it's Professor Roll-Up. Professor Roll-Up and his best friend, Detective Headlock.
So there's this huge info dump right here where the vampire women's motivation is all laid out. They are trying to get Diana, bring her to them, and make her the new queen. Tundra does this crazy incantation slash prayer that brings all the other vampire women out of their coffins. But only Diana, I guess there's only enough power in the queen currently to make Diana, or I'm sorry, Tundra, look young again. So she is instantly transformed into a young-looking woman. She also says some kind of prayer about how the sun won't damage her. And she goes upstairs and, like, stands in some sunlight for a minute.
Well, Satan shows up at that point.
Yeah. And she's fine with that now. She won't be later.
Yeah. Well, she says, like, hey, Satan, quick request, RQ. Could you make it so that we can't be harmed by the sun or the cross or any of that stuff? Thanks.
And that works temporarily, but I guess it's only like a 24-hour deal or something like that.
Well, I think it has to do with how much blood they've consumed, because once Tundra goes and gets some blood, she hooks up the rest of her clan and or her clatch, I guess, and they all start turning young. But I think they start to weaken the when they don't feed. They don't really address it, but it seems, at least, you know, tacitly, that's how that works.
Well, wait a second. The queen of the vampires, the one who wears the tiara, that's Thorina. That's not Selene. That's Thorina.
Oh, okay. I thought it was.
So Serene is that moon goddess. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're not going to try to figure that out right now. Yeah. Tundra also goes upstairs. She stands in the sunlight for a second, and she wakes up these dead bodies of these very, very burly men.
Burly is exactly the word for it.
Yeah, they have old-timey...
They're tough grandpas.
Yeah, they're like dock workers.
Old-timey luchador bodies. One of them is bald and looks like they just injected Max Schreck, who played Nosferatu, up with tons of roids. And then the other two of them have these kind of like weird pompadours. And they immediately leave and go try to find Diana at her house, where she lives with her dad, who is Professor Roll-Up. And she is also there talking to her fiancé, who she is going to announce her wedding to the following day at a costume party, which they keep calling a masquerade ball, but that's not the same thing as a costume party. And also the following night is her birthday, when she's going to turn 21. So the next night is going to be a huge night. Again, the next scene is just this huge info dump where all this information is given about her getting married, about her birthday party. There's a police inspector who hasn't been invited yet but has already got his costume planned out. He's going to be Sherlock Holmes.
Who then doesn't wear said costume ever.
He does not. He shows up in a suit to the party. And he explains how he's going to come and try to protect Diana, because Professor Roll-Up is worried about her safety, but will not say why. He will not explain.
He summoned the inspector. Like, he said, I asked you to come here. I need, you know, Diana's in trouble. And so, like, any good inspector is like, well, what's the trouble? What am I protecting her against? It's like, I can't tell you at all.
Yeah. And we never quite find out how much the professor actually knows. He keeps reading these old documents that look like they're full of hieroglyphics. Apparently, it's just like the most basic symbol equals a letter code. Because later in the movie, he's looking at the documents and he goes, A, B, I've got it. And he's just cracked the symbol code.
These hieroglyphics are amazing. Because first of all, this is a prophecy that would have been written presumably after the handoff failed in 1761, which means they are vampire hieroglyphic prophecies from 200 years before this movie.
But written like they came out of Egypt in, you know, 2,000 or 4,000 years ago.
They are on papyrus.
Yeah, are they supposed to be like, what are they supposed to be? Are they supposed to be some kind of Aztec?
Yeah, like I could have forgiven if they had some kind of, you know, Mayan look to them, like that, you know, that's a square letter form, you know, pictographs that they have. But no, they straight up have like, you know, Osiris and stuff in them.
They're hieroglyphics. But unless they are, and we are never given this information, unless they're like older prophecies that were like, okay, look, in 1761, the handoff's going to fail. But then 200 years later, there's going to be this wrestler.
Yeah.
Named El Santo, who's going to help out because these vampires are going to have a headquarters in the White Pine Forest. Nothing about this prophecy makes sense. And prophecies are like the easiest thing to pull off in fiction because you already know what is going to happen.
So later in the movie, the professor cracks the code, but there's a scene after he talks to the inspector where the inspector says he's going to come the following night to the party, even though he doesn't know what he's going to be there protecting anybody against. But there's a scene after that where he's like looking at the scrolls with a magnifying glass and seemingly reading it. Like there's a voiceover where he's giving like this prophecy about how, I guess, Diana is going to become the new vampire queen. So he seemingly knows that this is coming.
He also knows that there's a man in a silver mask, or a man who will he says a young man, too, which is funny because, you know, Santo's 45 in this movie. But he says there's a young man who will disguise his face in a silver mask. I mean, it's not even oblique at all. It is just literal, you know. There's a man 5'6", 280 with, you know, brown eyes who will wear a silver mask. So the only thing he doesn't seem to know is the hideout. I think he references that a few times, and that seems to be the only real point of contention in the entire movie, because he kind of knows what they're trying to do. He knows their whole shtick. He knows who can help her, who may be able to help her, because there's a big may in there or might in there. But where they are is the only thing that they can't figure out, because I think we all know that once they figure out where they're at, it's only a matter of time.
Yeah, once they figure out where they're at, it is like 5 minutes from the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And but the thing is, where they're at is Professor Rollup's ancestral home that is a creepy old castle full of vampires in the woods. That's the first place you should look.
Yeah, at no point is anyone like, have we thought of, like, and this whole thing is, you know, has to do with your family and lineage. Have we checked your old house out?
Yeah, he's literally related to them. He's also related to the vampires.
Also, it is very hard to figure out what Professor Rollup is an actual professor of. It seems like it might be religion or anthropology, because he studies a lot of...
I just think it's religion because of that time at the beginning where his daughter's fiance is like, we're going to get married, and then you'll be taking my orders. And he's like, yes, quite so.
Yes, but then, okay, Tundra goes to their house. She shows up in Diana's window, and Diana sees her in the mirror. Again, that seems like something that shouldn't happen, because one of the oldest bits of vampire mythology is that you can't see vampires in mirrors. However,
well, she shows up in the window and kind of mesmerizes Diana, who then walks outside or walks toward the door, and then her father and fiance kind of break it up, and the fiance goes out and sees the butterfly fly by, and
which is actually a bat, but they say it's a butterfly flying around outside at night.
Oh, Matt, are you saying that there might be some confusion about what a bat is in this movie?
Yeah. I don't think the word bat is actually ever used.
No, they are just called vampires. It is said in the prophecy that whoever has the mark of a vampire upon their shoulder is going to be the girl who has to become the new queen of the vampires. And they just mean a bat.
Yeah.
And
Diana, then later in the movie, Diana has a bat birthmark on her shoulder.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of translation issues in this. Bat and vampire being fungible terms is one of them.
Later in the movie,
costume and masquerade.
Yes. Later in the movie, a cop actually watches Tundra transform into a bat. And he says, I saw her turn into a vampire.
Yeah, that's when they're, like, people are talking to this cop after the thing. And somebody says something about vampires. And he goes, yeah, now that I think of it, they probably were vampires. Because he saw them turn into bats and drink blood.
Yeah, and he did not think to mention that until somebody brought it up.
So when, what's her name, Diana? Is that who the young girl is?
Yes.
Yes.
The girl who's about to turn 21. She sees this vampire in her mirror, clearly, very clearly, and then screams, and her dad comes in, and he tells her, light does strange things when it bounces off a mirror, which I guess is true if you think about it.
It does then, reverse everything.
Yep. Then, a moment later, Professor Rollup goes back to his office, and Tundra shows up in his window, because this is all she does at this point. Like, this is her entire plan, is just to show up in these people's windows and stare them down and try to hypnotize them.
She's a peeper.
She is totally a peeper.
She's literally just a peeper.
Professor Rollup deals with that by telling her, by just mentioning God, which also makes you think that he might be a professor of religion. He says, in God's name, get out of here. And she turns into a bat and flies away immediately. That's when he turns on his Jack Kirby communication devices in his office and calls up El Santo and says, hey, El Santo, I got to deal with some vampires here. They're trying to take my daughter. Come help me out. When you get this message, let me know. Because we see a shot in this big screen in his office of what looks like El Santo's crazy science fiction science lab with a reel-to-reel tape recorder inside of it.
That's connected to his video phone.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Santo is not there. Santo is participating in a 9-minute wrestling match that is in this movie in its entirety.
It is a 2 out of 3 falls tag team match presented yeah. in its entirety.
And Santo doesn't even seem to be into this match that much. He is not selling at all.
It's okay. Look. The thing that I said while I was watching this was that this movie does not really give you the impression that Santo is a very good wrestler. There is one kind of amazing move in this match, which is El Santo's finisher, which it looks like he dies because he does like a senton, like a swanton, really, off the top rope while his partner is holding a guy in the camel clutch, and that looks like it is going to kill at least 2 of them. It is pretty amazing.
He does,
but other than that, like, there are no tags in this match at all.
Yeah, people just come into the ring whenever they feel like it. He also does that senton.
They're real fast and loose with the wrestling moves or wrestling rules in most of this movie.
They really are. He does that senton later on in the movie, and that one comes off a little cleaner because I think the guy in the second match is maybe a more trained wrestler than yep. any of the other wrestlers in this match.
Now, do you remember who he's wrestling in this first match?
Did you? It was a caveman something. Oh, what was his name? Caveman something. And then, like, you know, was Victor Rodriguez.
The other one.
Yeah, it was like one guy with a, like, yeah, Victor Rodriguez.
His name was Mendoza.
Oh, there you go.
Mendoza. And I don't remember what caveman's last name was.
I am pretty sure it was like Caveman Wilson. Like it was the most the whitest name in this film.
And he looks kind of like the luchador version or the wrestling version of what's his name from Midnight Cowboy?
John Voight.
John Voight, yeah, from Midnight Cowboy. He's got just the fringe jacket and the fringe. It's not singlet, but the Speedo's on, trunks on.
So Santo and his partner win the match, and then Santo disappears from the movie for another 15 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. It's 25 minutes. It's 25 minutes and 46 seconds before Santo shows up. Then he wrestles a 9-minute match, and then he goes away for a while.
And we go to the following night. We skip the entire day of the next day. And we just go to the following night when this
party... Well, to be fair, it's vampires who drive the story, so not much is going to happen during the day.
I guess that's true, but it seems like Santo would have gotten in touch with the professor sometime the following day.
I was waiting on the scene where Santo would go into his science lab and check out his experiments. That does not happen. Instead, some vampire shit happens. That scene with the cop that we talked about, where
they attack a guy and take his blood and put it in a goblet.
Right, and that's how Thorina comes back to life, the queen of the vampires.
And also all the other vampire women get young again by drinking that blood.
Yeah, one of the best scenes in the movie is when, is it Tundra is the first vampire that we see?
She's the one who does all the work.
Okay, so Tundra goes to get this goblet, and there is just a giant snake coiled around it. And she just reaches out and picks up the snake, drops it on the floor, and then picks up the goblet. This, like, she is moving aside a coffee cup to get the one she wants. It's amazing.
So after all the vampire women are rejuvenated by this blood, we move on to the big scene of the masquerade party, which is actually a costume party.
Now, is this where does Santo show up after the masquerade party?
Was it right after the professor expels Tundra? When he is that when El Santo, or is it after the professor finds out about the guy? They go see the girl, the victim, right? You see the girl with the two holes in her neck and has no blood, and they're like, don't know what did this, as if no one in the movie had ever heard of vampires before, even though they call bats vampires.
The cop is talking about how it had to be vampires, and the coroner is like, poppycock, there's no way that can be a vampire.
It's just an unknown animal.
Yeah, it's some animal we've not discovered yet.
It's a chupacabra.
Yeah.
So,
Santo doesn't show up at the party until after everything has happened. And he shows up, he drives up in his sweet little car and starts fighting the burly vampire guys out in a field.
But he meets with the professor before that, because he shows up in his study, and then he is, hey, are you going to be at the party tomorrow? And Santo's like, nah, I'm busy. I got a thing to do.
That's right. There is that scene where he tells the professor, I'm busy with something else.
Then the party happens, and they go to great lengths to let you know there's lots of guards around, and no one's supposed to get in there without an invitation. Then the vampire and her and my favorite henchman show up. And she beckons the fiance and Diana are dancing, and she beckons the fiance away, and then the vampire goes and dances with her. I think that's when the professor notices there's some trouble.
There's also a scene where Tundra and one of the henchmen go out into like the garden area. They lure away a couple of guests, one of whom is dressed as like one of the Three Musketeers, and they knock them out. Because all those vampire henchmen do, even though they have vampire fangs, is beat people up. They just are involved in fisticuffs. They never do any vampire shit to anybody. It's all fists. So they beat up those two guests, and it looks like they're going to take their costumes, or at least their invitations. And neither of those things happen. Tundra and the henchmen just walk into the party. There's a guy who kind of like notices that he hasn't seen them before. So he walks over to them and starts to ask Tundra, hey, do you have an invitation? And Tundra just like does some like hypnotism through her eyes. And he walks back over to the door, and another guard guy goes, are they okay? And he just slowly starts nodding his head.
Well, the thing that I wanted to talk about with Santo actually showing up and talking to Professor Rollup is that, first of all, Santo's about a foot shorter than Professor Rollup, which makes him, like, for Santo to enter the action by walking into a room where a non-combatant in the movie is very much taller than him, not a great introduction. Find another. Recast Professor Rollup, guys.
Yeah, also, Santo's still in the same gear he was wrestling in. This isn't, like, that's one of the things I didn't care for, is you never see him in a suit with the mask on. He's always in his wrestling gear.
And his cape.
Yes.
And his cape.
I also have a guy who wears a cape, so I can't shit talk to him. But I guess he does wear more suits than El Santo does in this movie.
The other thing, though, is that the professor and El Santo have this conversation that has nothing to do with vampires. The professor just goes, yes, you know, there are evil men in this world who would use our scientific achievements to destroy us. And Santo goes, ah, yes, nuclear energy. And it's like, and first of all, that's perfect, and I love that it's in there. But also, that is, like, Santo, that is not the discussion at hand. The discussion at hand is vampire women.
Yeah, he just went into his left-wing politics all of a sudden.
Well, it's, and also,
turned into Greenpeace. Goddamn this, whalers.
This is where we hear, where did that come from? This is where we hear Santo's voice dubbed, act, like the actor who does his dubbing. And we were making several different jokes about what it sounded like it was W.C. Fields or whatever. It actually sounds like season one Simpsons Homer Simpson, where he's like, oh, yeah. Oh yes, nuclear energy. Where it's just like this super weird voice coming out of El Santo.
Yeah, I think the people made the movie, or the people who made the dub, assumed that his voice would be affected by his mask somehow. Like, oh, he's in a mask, so obviously there'd be a little muffle to it. And you're like, well, you know his lips are showing through the mask, right? Like, no one thought to fact check that.
Anyway, at the party, after Tundra and her henchmen get in, the professor pretty quickly notices that they're there and that something's up. So he tells the inspector and the other cops, hey, those people are vampires. Go get them. They shouldn't be here. So they end up chasing them out of the house and out into a grassy yard area. This is when El Santo shows up in his little tiny car and starts just wailing on the vampire henchmen. Yet, all the vampires get away. They turn into bats and various things and get away.
You mean vampires?
Into vampires.
Yes. when they're in the party, and that's when he tells them, like, hey, go get those guys. That's when when Tundra turns the light off, and it's like they set a tear gas bomb off in the house.
Yeah, the room, like, there's so much shrieking in the room when a light goes off. El Santo jumps back in his car and chases after them, but that is the end of that scene. We do not see anything that happens after that. Apparently they just get away, and Santo gives up and goes back home, or goes and wrestles in his next wrestling match, which I guess is the next thing we see, right? Like, the second wrestling match pretty much happens immediately after that.
Is the second wrestling match is the one against the vampire assassin, right?
Well, we'll get to how confusing that is in a second.
Because this, like, spoiler warning, high points this entire match.
Oh, yeah.
The first match, garbage. The first match, honestly, terrible. Takes up a lot of time. Nothing really happens. Nobody sells anything. It's just people hitting each other for a little while. Second match, great.
In this, well, we cut to a match that El Santo isn't in. It's just, as Gonzo said as we were watching, it's the undercard. There's this match going on, and then we cut back to the locker room. And there's this wrestler and his manager. The wrestler, we later find out, is Black Mask. And he's wearing a black mask. He tells his manager, I've got to get ready for my match with El Santo in an hour.
Going to take a nap.
Yeah, so he lays down in the most uncomfortable position you could imagine a person laying down in. And one of the vampire henchmen crawls in through the window, walks over to a chair, and shakes it around to wake the guy up. So they can have a fight. And then
That was a baller move, I gotta say. That was a great little character touch. That guy is my favorite of all of the vampires. Vampire henchman.
He's got this great little pompadour, and he's got this, like, weird swagger about him, right?
Yeah, well, his body language throughout the entire thing, because most of those vampire henchmen, or goons, I guess, are pretty emotionless, but he's got a posture that just sells a lot of what he's doing. He's got great body language.
Well, there's that guy who has the sort of braggadocio, right? And then there's the bald guy who is literally, like, hunched over like Nosferatu. Like, throughout the movie, he just confirmed to me that he was roided out Nosferatu. And then there's a third guy who kind of doesn't do a lot.
Chris's grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah, the guy who looks exactly like my grandpa.
So they have a fight in the locker room that ends with the vampire henchman choking him to death.
Matt, surely you mean that he drinks his blood or does anything a vampire might do.
No, he puts his hands around his neck and chokes him to death. Now here's the confusing part. Because we cut directly from that to the match between Black Mask and El Santo.
Well, the manager comes in and says, hey, you got to get ready. And they do the hard work of getting his cape on him.
That's right. He says, he puts the cape on him. He goes, oh, we did it. Let's get out there. But we don't see any moment of the quick change, right? We don't see the mask being taken off and the henchman putting the mask on. We just see another guy wearing the mask, and the original Black Mask has apparently been disposed of. He is not in the room anymore.
Maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm still not sure if this guy is supposed to be the vampire henchman wearing the mask, or if this is Black Mask, who I think was Black Shadow, I think is his actual wrestling name, who has been turned into some kind of vampire thrall. Well, that is not very clear.
He's a wolf man. The match ends with Santo taking the guy's mask off because he tried to take Santo's mask off first. Well, we should note that.
We need to talk a little bit about the match.
Oh, we need to talk about this match.
Well, we'll talk about the story stuff. Let's talk about the story stuff and then talk about the match. Okay. So his mask gets taken off, and he is a wolfman. He is in full wolfman makeup.
And he is in I Was a Teenage Werewolf makeup.
And Gonzo, you observed that the crowd's reaction to the guy in the ring being a wolfman and being shot by police point blank is less intense.
From like a foot and a half away. Yeah. It was kind of brutal.
Is less intense than lights going off at a party. Like, they're upset, but they're not screeching the way that people at that party were. But yeah, he's a wolfman. I don't think he's that vampire henchman, because the vampire henchman shows up in the next scene not looking like a wolfman and not shot in the chest. So
yeah, well,
either
those guys take bullets before, but yeah, he definitely isn't Wolfman anymore when we see him again. So I don't know if they corrupted Black Mask into being a Wolfman or just had a Wolfman on call that they reported.
My theory is that he just went over to the phone, he called up 1-800-WOLFMAN and said, hey, you busy tonight? I need some help. It was a Wolfman in there, and then the police got in the ring and shot him. That's how that scene ends. Let's talk about the match a little bit.
Santo is fighting this guy, but this dude is just beating the shit out of El Santo, and he is karate chopping him constantly, like just chopping the hell out of him. And like Santo is actually selling, which I wonder if the purpose of that first match was to be like, oh yeah, you know, these guys cannot hurt El Santo, he is beyond human. So when this guy does it, it actually means something. But I think you could just cut out that first match and be fine. So eventually, there is the first fall in the match.
It's announced at the beginning that it's a three falls match,
which I think it's supposed to be. It's a 2 out of 3 falls match, and Brian Doyle Murray, who's doing the voiceover for the announcer, just gets it wrong. He gets chopped down and pinned, and then his corner man comes in, who is this very large gentleman, and says like, "Hey, Santo, you okay? That guy's vicious." And Santo says, he's been using karate. He could kill me with one blow.
He says, that's not Black Mask. He's been using karate.
Yeah.
But up until that point, too, he also had some moves beyond that. Like, he was doing that weird kind of RKO where he had his feet on the top rope thing.
And it was great. Like,
yeah. He had that guy. His body language in this is amazing. Just that ferocity kind of hyped up. He's like one of the war boys from Mad Max. He's just like hyped up to you know, kill El Santo or die trying. It was great. Yeah, that guy this match is fucking amazing.
The match begins with like the bell ringing, and he's like turned around in the corner with his back to El Santo, and he just like immediately swings around and charges at El Santo, like he's a wolf. Like, if I had known then that he was supposed to be a wolf man, I would have been like, wow, he is perfectly being a wolf man right now. Because he, like, almost moves kind of like a, you know, a wolf, a guy pretending to be a wolf, right?
Well, if this guy is the wrestler that I'm thinking of, who's Black Shadow, he does have a long history of wrestling, specifically with El Santo. El Santo is the wrestler who unmasked him in real life. So, yeah, maybe he's using this movie to get some revenge. But probably not. They probably just work really well together. Anyway, point being, at the end of this fight, when he is unmasked, he is a karate werewolf luchador. That is, like, that was the first time I was excited about this movie.
Yeah, and then we cut from there. So then the first fall happens, and then he sells him. Yeah, he's using karate. And then the second match just goes like to a full like karate fest, right? Or the second fall?
Yeah, because Santo starts like chopping him back, and I don't even think we get a second fall in the match. I think it just ends when Santo unmasks him and reveals that he is a werewolf,
and then the police shoot him.
Yeah,
so yeah, then they cut back to
we're gonna call that a DQ or
exactly. So that's a fall. That counts as a fall.
I think that's
but then we jump cut from contest. Like, the chaos of that to them sitting at the diner or the sitting at the restaurant where they're using Diana as bait. Because did we touch on that part where their scheme is now?
Because the professor asks Santo, like, hey, these vampires are really coming after my daughter on her 21st birthday. So is there any way you can show up and protect her? And Santo's like, no, I have a prior engagement. And the prior engagement is a wrestling match.
Yes. So there's a few different things going on here. Everybody's regrouping while Santo is having his wrestling match. The Tundra has gone back to the Vampire Queen and said, like, yeah, okay, so we tried to go to the party and get Diana, but Santo was there, and there were cops there, and we couldn't get her. And the Vampire Queen just tears into her, and she goes, I will turn you into fucking dust. If you do not come back here with my successor, because I'm leaving the throne. My reign is almost done.
I gotta go down to hell and be with my husband, Satan.
Go get Diana and bring her here. Because if you don't, this is what I'll do. And then she just turns to two of the vampire women and makes examples out of them and turns them into dust.
Classic supervillain style.
Yeah, it is baller as hell when she does that shit. Meanwhile, at the professor's house, the inspector is there, and they're trying to figure out like how these people started showing up with bite marks on their necks, what could be going on. The inspector's piecing it all together. He's like, maybe it's those vampires that were biting people on the neck, and I bet they're also after Diana, too. It's all coming together. So here's how we're going to catch them. We're going to use Diana as bait. We're going to take her to a restaurant, to a club, and we're going to have her sit there until the vampires show up, and then we're going to take them down. And the professor, for one moment, goes, is that such a great idea? I don't know if we should really use my daughter as bait. And Diana steps up, and she goes, they're going to just keep coming after me, because I guess they don't know that it has to happen tonight, or it ain't going to happen. Like, this is it. This is the one opportunity they have to get Diana on her 21st birthday. So they say, like, they're going to keep coming after me unless we do something. So I'm happy to go out there and be bait instead of just having to worry about this for the rest of my life. And they end up convincing the professor that it's okay. That scene is just about telling the professor he's wrong. That is all that scene is. So they go to this club/restaurant where there's this guy playing the piano and singing a song. He is one of the few people that are not dubbed in the movie. He and the audience at the wrestling match are the only ones that are not dubbed, because he's singing in Spanish. And at the wrestling match, even though Santo's name is supposed to be Samson, they are chanting Santo, Santo, Santo. They're at the restaurant. The Queen and Tundra show up at the restaurant and just seat themselves. They do not give a fuck about a hostess. They just sit down.
Who knows, that waiter could have been triple sat at that point. They don't even know that they're getting a drink order. Although yeah. the sommelier comes right over, like doesn't give a fuck that they sat themselves. He's like, oh, I guess I...
And they're kind of sitting behind this weird pillar in the restaurant to sort of hide themselves. But
well, I think it's because Diana's seen Tundra a bunch, and so she sits behind the pillar so that all they can see is the vampire queen. What's her name, Chris?
Therina.
Therina, yeah, they can see Therina. Because Therina really just went there to get a look at her successor, because she only hangs out to get the look, and then she takes off.
But Diana is doing her makeup at the table, and she has a compact in her hand with a mirror. And she's looking in the mirror, and she sees a reflection of the vampires again. But this time the reflection isn't just a normal reflection. It's a reflection of them as they were before they drank the blood and turned young-looking again. They still kind of look all messed up with the crazy monster makeup. This tips them off that they're the vampires, and the inspector who is sitting with her jumps up and turns to them. They disappear. They, like, go away in a puff of smoke, and he points to them and says, "Arrest those women," even though they're already gone. Outside, the vampire henchmen have been beating the shit out of all the cops, so they're all done for. Like, they are just beat to hell. And this all results in the cops being so disorganized that the vampire women actually do get custody of Diana and take her to the castle.
Well, I'm trying to remember what happens, because Santo shows up as they're beating the shit out of the cops, right? That's where he has the fight out on the field with them? Or there's just the two of the vampire guys?
Yeah, there's another fight out on the field with Santo.
There's a couple of fights out in the yard. With, like, the first hour of this movie just kind of blends together. There's no real sequence of events.
There's a lot of, like, stuff just repeat. A lot of stuff happens twice. Like,
yes. There are two wrestling match happens twice. Santo fighting in the yard happens twice.
There are two party scenes. There are two scenes where the vampire queen kind of yells at Tundra. Like, oh, there's a lot of repetition happening right at the beginning of the movie. But this is where the professor is looking at the hieroglyphics, because he's really got to figure this out now, because they have Diana. And he figures out that it's just this weird, basic, a symbol equals a letter code.
Now, where is El Santo going? Because then he jumps and he springs to his little communication device, which also apparently just finds El Santo wherever he is, because if he's in the science lab, it'll go straight to his voicemail there. And if he's in his car, it rings him up on the car. Where was Santo coming from? I can't remember that he was in his car.
I guess he's coming directly from the wrestling match, right?
Or he's coming from the restaurant after he jumped in for the save there. Because the professor calls him up and says, "Hey, I finally figured out where the vampire women's headquarters is. It's that old castle that my family used to have."
Well, wait a minute. Is he? That's when El Santo was driving, chasing that one vampire who sees the cross and then just goes poof in like a half second.
There is a part here. I think this is after they figured out where they are, though. But there is a part where Santo chases after one of the vampire henchmen, and the henchman just like ducks behind a wall to hide from Santo. And Santo's like, that shit ain't gonna work on me. So he stops the car, but it doesn't matter at that point, because then the henchman sees a cross and immediately bursts into flames.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no hesitation, he is now cinders on the ground. So Santo jumps back in the car and drives to the crazy white woods to where the castle is. The vampire women have started their ceremony to try to make Diana their new queen, while Santo walks in to the house and he's checking out all the cobwebs. He's kind of walking around. There's a moment where he looks at the owl that just hangs out in the castle. And then he goes rushing in to try to save Diana, and a gate comes crashing down, a cage, and traps
him. Oh, two gates, yeah. They hit him from both sides.
Yeah, so he gets trapped. The vampire henchmen, I guess, kind of beat him up, and they strap him to a table. And there's just this great moment where they're punching him in the face repeatedly, and he is not selling any of that shit.
Not a bit of it.
Just jumping right back up. Then Santo doesn't really do anything. This is just a moment of the vampire women have terrible scheduling skills because the sun comes up, comes in the window, and everybody in that room immediately burns to ash. Like, it's like Santo doesn't even stop them. It's just the sun comes up and they burn up.
Well, I'd like to think that his being a nuisance all of this time has set their plan back so far that they're really pushing the last minute here.
Yeah, maybe that's what El Santo accomplished. He set back their schedule so badly that they couldn't make it till morning, having accomplished this.
So then Santo gets up. He sees Diana strapped to the table next to him. There is no dialogue exchange, but he basically gives her the, "You good? We good? You okay?" He gives her that look, and then leaves the room, grabs a torch off the wall, goes down into the dungeon, and just starts opening up coffins and setting shit on fire.
It is spectacular.
Like, there was a moment where we were like, hey, is Santo gonna not just fight these guys? Is he actually just gonna burn them down? And then we looked and it's like, well, there's 2 minutes left in the movie.
And he just murders the fuck out of all of them.
Also, did we talk about him jumping off the balcony?
Oh, no, yeah, because he...
Did we talk about him going new jack on this enemy.
He gets free from having been punched in the face, they then go to pull his mask off. That's when the sun comes up. Tundra bursts into flames. The male henchmen that are still there start freaking out because of the sun. He frees himself, and then I think that's when he beats the fuck out. That's when he beats them up and goes off. Goes to leave, I think, doesn't he?
He's trying to just get upstairs to get to that balcony and then jumps on them from that balcony.
Yeah, which is the best wrestling move with a vampire I think he uses the entire time. But then they burst into flames, and that's when he looks at Diana and is like, be right back.
Yeah, this scene of him just pulling open coffins and setting things on fire is, like we said, this thing's on YouTube. Just go skip to the last 3 minutes and watch this for yourself, because it is amazing. And then it is immediately followed by a speech from Professor Rollup that is like, Santo represents the best of us. It's like, all right.
He is okay. A paragon.
Annihilating evil. That's the best of us there.
He is a paragon of justice. They talk about Santo as Gonzo, you said this. They talk about Santo as if they will never see him again.
Yeah. So like Diana goes, who is he? And Professor Rollup goes, we may never know.
For him to know, I think. Or that's his secret. That's what he says. That's his secret.
That's his secret. And he may never reveal it.
That's right.
It's like, okay.
He has a wistful tone about them as if he's riding off to the next town. But I'm like, no, he still has the science lair. You can call him on any time.
Yeah, you still have a direct video phone line. And he will also be at the arena next week.
Oh, man. But yeah, it's that real kind of Gone with the Wind well up of music. You know, the end of Shane kind of, you know. Like, it's like, not really. He's going to be every Thursday and Saturday for the next month. He's going to be down at the sports complex. So.
I like to imagine that Professor Rollup just went home and smashed all his communication equipment for El Santo. Like, I'll never see him again.
It seems like his entire field of study to become a professor was just to break this curse from his family. So really, what is the second act for him? We should look into the Wolfman problem that we apparently have that no one's addressed.
All right, let's do high points of El Santo versus the vampire women.
All right, the entire second match.
Yes.
With Black Shadow, which is great.
Yes. Also, the last 4 minutes or so of the movie, where people are just catching on fire, or vampires are just catching on fire out of nowhere, and then Santo burns the shit out of all of them.
Yes.
I really liked the Kirby tech was fucking amazing. It literally looked like Jack Kirby designed all of the tech in this movie. And I thought the sexiness of the women and the thuggishness of the brutishness of the men, male vampires, was kind of great. Like, and I really like that the bad guys, there's like, they kill people. Like, there's several people who die in this, and it's not, you know, nothing gets thwarted just in time, or they're not just menacing. Like, there's real stakes in that.
Yeah, I think, and it's nice, like, They have an interesting motivation. I mean, look, I need to destroy a younger and more beautiful woman so that I can go take my place beside Satan. Might not be the best motivation for a lady supervillain, but it is kind of good that they have that there are plans. There are, you know, complicated things that don't necessarily revolve around revenge on El Santo or even, you know, necessarily. Like, they're not just trying to corrupt this virtuous young girl. There is a little bit more to it.
Back to the look of the bad guys or their motivation or whatever. I think just generally, costumes and makeup in this movie are very good. Aside from the costumes at the quote-unquote masquerade ball, which are kind of universally terrible, and the fact that the inspector who said he was going to dress like Sherlock Holmes didn't. Like, all the makeup on the vampire women in both their kind of decrepit form and then in their, like, sexy 60 vampire girls form, like, really good. Like, they're instantaneously recognizable as vampires in both forms. And, like, their costumes are really great. The costumes of the male henchmen, fantastic. Santo's cape is wonderful. Even, like, the professor in his, like, really skinny tuxedo looks pretty good. I think, like, costumes and makeup universally throughout this movie, pretty spot on, pretty good.
Also, there's a karate werewolf luchador, which is a high point, not of this movie, but of film and humanity.
Human culture, yeah.
Yes.
What are the low points of...
It's really boring.
Yeah.
It takes a while to get going.
For the first hour, at least, it's... Like, because the second wrestling match doesn't happen until the start of the second act, which is more than an hour into the movie.
We say this a lot on the show, and Gonzo, I think you've said it already just in this episode, but, like, there's a cut of this movie that's literally half as long as it is that's highly entertaining. Like, there's so much you could cut out.
There's no reason for that first wrestling match to be in the movie. There's no reason other than for El Santo to show up sooner than half an hour in.
There's no reason for the opening scene to be 9 minutes and have, like, you know, 4 minutes of just a creepy establishing shot of this castle.
Yeah, there's no dialogue until probably about 4 minutes in. It's just these lingering shots of this castle set, which are not really necessary at all.
I mean, they literally could have gone from exterior shot of the castle to interior of the dungeon and the casket's opening.
Yes. They could have gone, like, we don't really need the party. We don't really need the scene before the party scene. We just need the scene where the professor is taught, like, she plays the entirety of Moonlight Sonata.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need any of that. We could have just had Professor Rollup talking to his friend about how he's worried that someone's coming after his daughter.
That could have gone on while the song was going on.
Yes.
Could have pulled someone aside and said, hey, you know, I'm a little worried about her. I had this big day tomorrow, you know. There's this thing. I mean, a lot of stuff could have happened simultaneously, but they just let it all play out way longer than it should.
Well, there are two complete songs in the movie, because there's her playing Moonlight Sonata, and then when they're at the restaurant later, the guy at the piano sings his entire song.
Right, Phil Collins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, in joke for our commentary during the movie.
He had no jacket required. That's
exactly. There's just so much in this movie that is boring and repetitive and not exciting. Like, the first wrestling match is bad. Like, the first wrestling match is not exciting or interesting or fun. You don't see Santo do anything that makes you think he's a cool guy. Like, he doesn't pull off any amazing feats of strength. He just doesn't sell anything, so we kind of know he's tough. But for us, that just means, like, oh, this guy's a bad wrestler.
Aside from a guy being named Caveman.
Well,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. But I think the editing overall is one of my low points, because they really, like I said, things could have happened simultaneously had they edited them better. And I think even the action is just that kind of, you know, wide shot of the people in the wrestling ring. Like, they don't really cut in for close-ups. They don't really give you any good reaction shots. You know, like, You know, even HBO, when it broadcasts live boxing, still will, you know, cut between like a wide shot and a close-up shot in different angles at least. But you just get that head-on shot of the ring, and then the match plays out in its entirety as if you were just sitting in the audience watching the match.
Well, I think,
but without the proximity of being there.
I think that's a problem throughout the movie, because even in the fight scenes where El Santo is fighting the henchmen in the yards, like in the grassy areas, those are wide shots that never get in any closer to the fights either.
There was only one shot in this movie that any of us said, like, oh, that's a cool shot, which is where, like, one of the detectives is really close up to the camera looking around kind of furtively and then turns around and walks further down the set. But there's no camera movement. Also, I don't know how much of this is a translation issue, but nothing in this movie makes sense.
Well, I was going to get into this because some of it's translation, like obviously the bat vampire stuff. Seems to have been a translation problem. The masquerade costume stuff seems to be a translation problem. But also, like, this movie spends so much time on establishing shots, but doesn't bother to show who that wolfman is in the black mask and where he came from, and that he's not the henchman that choked the original black mask to death. Which left us all, like, we all thought the wolfman, karate wolfman luchador was cool. But it was also confusing when he got unmasked. Like, wait, was that guy? Did he turn into a wolfman? Or what's going on with that?
Yeah, I want to say a little bit of the translation issue, too, was the dubbing. For me, one of the low points was the voices they chose for almost everybody.
Yeah, it's like Santo should have a slightly more heroic voice than this guy.
Than original, yeah. Than original season one Homer Simpson.
Boy,
let's go out for frosty chocolate milkshakes.
Nothing really makes sense. None of, like, I do kind of like that they don't establish why Santo is their go-to dude for these problems when they live in a city with police. I kind of love that it's just accepted, like, hey, look, I think there's vampires. We really need to use the science phone to call Santo. Like, but it would have been nice if Santo was like, yes, you know, I've traveled around the world and I've seen a lot of strange things.
Well, one of the things, too, that I found was a low point, or one of the things I was going to mention as a low point, was they don't delve into the Lucha mythos at all. Like, they don't really even delve into the vampire mythos at all. Like, we've talked about how they definitely have their own take on the vampire mythos. Like, you know, they can be seen in mirrors and the crosses are more effective than sunlight even, and that sort of thing. But they never really kind of spell out what vampires are or what they might, you know, what they might want, I guess, other than the motivations we get from that opening scene. But they definitely don't get into, like, luchadors and what it means to be a luchador. Like, I've heard you talk about Batman 66 and where they don't really do a lot of explanation, but they definitely at least let you know the import of those people. Like, when you say, like, God, don't mess with that guy, he's a luchador. Like, you get a sense that there's someone to be awed and feared and what have you. And this, they're not even treated like that. He's just a dude in a mask and tights and a cape who comes to solve problems. They don't give him any gravitas at all, nor do they detract from it either. But they also don't expand on any of, like, the importance of the mask and why it was such a big deal that he was pulling off the mask or anything like that.
Yeah, and back to the vampire stuff, like, it seemed like at first, like, they were at least going to adhere to the they can't come in unless they're invited mythology.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, that's why Tundra is standing outside all the time just looking in the window. But then they just walk into that party.
Yeah, they drop in on the restaurant.
Yeah. They're not invited in at all. They just go in. So not even that holds up. Back to the stuff about the dubbing, though, I think – in addition to the dubbing, I don't know how much of it's the dubbing and how much of it's the acting, but the acting in this movie is pretty bad. Like, I made a comment as we were watching of, it seems like the entire direction, all the direction that any of the actors got was, hey, look around a lot. Because characters are just constantly, like, looking up at the ceiling and at the walls to show that they're, I don't know, I guess, alert, looking out for danger.
Yeah, you mentioned that's the entire, like, every detective or cop in this, their entire crime prevention method seems to be just to look around.
Yeah,
just left, then right, then left again.
The vampire women do it too. Like, it's just anything anybody does.
Yeah, well, they weren't going to move the camera, so they needed the actors to move their heads a lot.
All right, let's give our final thoughts about El Santo versus the vampire women.
One thing that I thought might be kind of fun to do, Matt, was to look at the plot keywords for this movie.
Okay.
On IMDb.
Yes.
And here's what we've got. You tell me if you think these are relevant. Bare-chested male bondage. Devil worshiper. Hero for hire. Greco-Roman wrestling. Does not apply. Muscle man. And character name and title.
Okay, character name and title and muscle man, definitely very accurate. The rest may be slightly accurate. Like, I guess technically bare-chested male bondage does occur, but I wouldn't say it's a focus.
Well, maybe not for you.
This being considered one of the best of the El Santo movies does not give me a lot of hope for the other ones, to be honest. Like, this one definitely, I think, is worth seeing, but I feel like you could lean on that fast forward quite a bit.
Yeah, I think the dudes who wrote this are all were all horror writers, like all the other movies that they wrote. And there's like four writers on this movie too. But I feel like you and I were hoping that it was a lot more of a lucha libre movie that had some horror aspects to it and less of a horror movie that that had like a luchador character that popped in and out of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like based on the writing staff that it was definitely a horror movie, and it's a horror movie from, you know, like 1961. And I think that we really don't like horror movies as they exist, you know, today don't really start to happen until like the mid to late 70s, you know? And then I think really in the past 10 years, horror has taken a leap forward to where they're cut together better and more interestingly. So they're more impactful. But when you look at like, you know, 50s horror movies and even 60s horror movies, they are these more atmospheric, long kind of drawn out things that are just punctuated with two or three moments of effect, 'cause that's all they really had budget for. And so I think they took the horror movie from the 60s sensibility and applied it to this and then threw a Mexican wrestler in there. And I think that it would be a better movie if it was a little more action, you know, like lucha libre centric. And unfortunately, that's not what we got here. But the good action kind of moments that do happen kind of make the other, you know, 80 minutes worth putting up with, you know.
As someone who has watched a lot of horror movies, I would compare this to a horror movie from the 30s or 40s. At one point I mentioned that it kind of feels like an Old Republic serial, and that is absolutely the feel that it has. Horror movies in the 50s and 60s leaned on sci-fi a lot, right? Like there was so much of that. And in the 60s, you started seeing horror kind of as we know it now with Night of the Living Dead and stuff like that, even though Night of the Living Dead is a slow-moving movie by today's standards, for sure. But this feels like... You know what it feels like to me? It feels like the old Abbott and Costello Meet Monsters movies, but with a luchador.
I did not know Abbott and Costello burn people to death in
yeah.
those movies.
It's like the luchador version. Instead of comedians, it's luchadors meeting these crazy monsters. It's very much a throwback to the horror movies of that era, I feel like. And in that sense, it very much feels like, you know, in line with movies of that time. So while certainly by our standards, it moves really slow and feels like there should be a lot more happening, if what was definitely the goal of the movie is to kind of match that feel and look and tone of the horror movies of, what, 30 years earlier? 20 to 30 years earlier, they kind of pulled it off.
Yeah, it did feel really like I mentioned when we were watching it. It did have a weird retro, like you know, from the 60s looking back 20 years and saying or 30 years. It seems like even at the time, if I had been living in the 60s and seen this, it would have seemed a little retro even then, or a lot retro even then.
Yeah,
but I think that just that kind of. Those two generations removed now, it feels a little, you know, yeah, it just felt a little slow. You know, I think we've all said that at least 10 times now.
if ever a movie cried out for a supercut, it is El Santo contra the Vampire Women.
All right, that's it for this episode of Movie Fighters. Jay Gonzo has been our guest. He is the writer and artist of La Mano del Destino, which you can get right now. Gonzo, where can people find you and buy your comics?
You can go to castleandkeypublications.com, and there's a store there. You can get all my comics there, and there's links to follow me on social media there as well. And that's all comic related. I am actually updating that site soon, but it's still up and functional now. But I apologize for the way it looks and feels. I'll be fixing that. And then personally, if people are interested in me, you know, like I guess as an artist or the other things I do, there's jgonzodesigns.com. And that also has like links to contact me and that sort of thing.
Gonzo also designed our current Movie Fighters logo, which
yes, the amazing. Shaw Brothers inspired logo.
It looks wonderful. You can see that at our website, which is moviefighterscast.com. If you'd like to send us an email with a suggestion for a movie or something else, a comment or a theme, or whatever, or a theme, that's right. You can do that at moviefighterscast@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @TheMattDWilson. Chris, where can people follow you?
People can find everything that I do at about.me/ChrisSims. There's links there to Twitter, Tumblr, all that good stuff, Comixology. Read me and Matt and Gonzo's comics. You'll like them a lot. Matt, we're coming up. We're getting close to Halloween, Matt.
We are. And we're also, I think, two episodes away from the end of season two of Movie Fighters.
And we don't have to do this anymore.
Well, we've got some plans in the works for what we're going to do about season three. I don't think another Kickstarter is what we're going to be doing. I think we're just going to be kicking it over to Patreon, which we already have existing for our other podcast, War Rocket Ajax. We'll let you know more about that in the weeks to come.
Matt, what do you think the odds are that we can do my Halloween suggestion and watch all the Resident Evil movies in reverse order?
Aren't there like 20 of those?
There are five.
We'd have to start in September.
You guys could bang out a couple in a day.
Yeah,
you know?
Knock them out, bro.
We'll see how that goes. We might have to make it like a special telethon event for the Patreon.
That's the way we fund season three. Just reverse order Resident Evil movies all day long.
We'll work out the details of that soon. But we wanted to let you know that our theme music is by Michael Kill. Our website was designed by Sean Bogus. We will be back in, I think it's going to be 3 weeks with another episode, because I'm going to be out of the country for a little while. But we will be back very soon with a brand new episode of Movie Fighters, closing out season two very soon. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening. See you later, everybody.